Okay, yeah, update on the Osmocom community TDM over IP status, where we are, where the problems are, what has changed during the last 6 months or so. So, yeah, that's just basically the bullet points from the invitation or from the announcement of the talk. Just a very brief recap of what the Osmocom community TDM over IP is. It's, well, as the name implies, a TDM network on top of the internet, so TDM over IP. It's meant as a community project, so no commercial service, but just random people with an interest connecting to it. And it is used to interconnect classic TDM equipment. At the moment, we only have ISDN service on top, but there's nothing in the architecture that would make it mandatory to do ISDN. So you could also do frame relay or X25 or ATM or God knows what. The audience is retro computing folks with an interest in networking, data communication, and hopefully at some point, I think we will also be able to market this in quotes to some museums so they can get digital phones and other digital communications equipment operational again, and in some kind of exhibit or something. So one of the things that happened in the past half year or so is that we have migrated the central hub to which all these TDM over IP connections connect from my basement to a data center in Nuremberg, Germany, at Norris Networks. They provide us with free power connectivity and co-location. Thanks for that again. There was a lot of preparatory work to get basically the GPS signal to our rack. I mean, just putting some server somewhere in a data center and installing some software and configuring it's not too special. But there was a lot of work to be done to actually get this GPS clock signal in the data center, specifically into our rack, in a way that we can use it. Since our hardware, the ICE1 USB, created by TNT, who's also here in the call tonight, uses a GPS, a built-in GPS receiver normally to create a very high precision clock for the TDM system. And having this proper clock in all parts, and particularly at the central hub, is of course rather important. So there was a lot of work needed because this is a very old data center in a very old building from, I don't know, maybe 50, 60 years ago. That was not built as a data center, but it used to be a pharmaceutical production site, actually. So it doesn't have like you, if you would build a modern data center today, you would have a shared GPS receiver and antenna distribution system or something like that normally for all the NTP and other equipment, but that's not the case there. So what we actually had to do is to put a physical GPS antenna on top of the roof and connect a GPS receiver within a reasonable coaxial cable length. And that GPS receiver then has RS422 output, which goes over about 110 or 105 meters of Cat5 twisted pair down into the data center, where we then use this one PPS and convert it back from RS422 to a normal CMOS logic level to drive the VCXO on the board. There's a couple of tickets related to that. I mentioned them here, and I linked them here. So in case you look at the slides later, you can look at that. These are some of the pictures. So first, there was some evaluation of, well, how do signals look, RS485 signals look like after you put them over 100 meters of cable. Initially, I simulated 100 meters of cable with this device, basically putting series resistance and parallel capacitors in the signal, looking at the slopes of what's happening there. Later on, then also looking what happens when you put these type approved overvoltage protection devices that, of course, you need to put if you want to connect anything that's on the roof where potentially you have overvoltage from nearby lightning strikes or something like that, and you put a cable into a data center, then you need overvoltage protection. That's one part of this that, of course, also has potential impact on the signal integrity. So actually, bought these devices and looked at the circuit board, reverse engineered the schematics, and actually we not only have these on like the normal commercial units on a DIN rail up on the roof, but we also have another set of overvoltage protection, which basically is the same schematics but on a custom board, which we can see here. Let's zoom into that for a second. This is the circuit board that is inside a rack mount enclosure where we have the RS422 signals arriving from this plug here on the left bottom. And then we have three pairs of signals. So we have three sets of overvoltage protection. And in the end, on this connector here, we have the output towards the units. We also have a 12-volt phantom voltage that is being supplied here to the GPS receiver, but in the end, we didn't use it because over the 100-plus meters of Cat5, you only get what something like 7 volts at the end of the cable, and that was not sufficient for the receiver. So the voltage is actually supplied on the roof from a DIN rail AC-DC converter. And this part here doesn't really get used. There's also a relay that would have enabled us to power cycle the this 12-volt phantom voltage, but as I said, this is not really used, so not relevant. It's in the board anyway. So that's part of the development that happened. Another part of the development is this nice add-on module for the IS-1 USB circuit board. TNT designed this. So what you can do with this module is that instead of using the onboard internal GPS receiver of the IS-1 USB, you can connect an external GPS receiver with this RS-422 signal, as I mentioned just before. So you plug this add-on board into your IS-1 USB, and then you can use these external GPS receivers just like you would have used an internal one. That, of course, also required some additional work on the gateway and firmware, and no, I don't think on the host software, but at least on those other bits. And thanks again for TNT to work on these. Yeah, then there was a server to be bought. There's no picture of the server itself here in this ticket, so we don't need to look at that. It's a Supermicro machine with an EPIC processor. So in the end, the logical setup, well, there's different diagrams. Here is a picture of the physical setup. Let's zoom into that. I'm not quite sure why this loading of the images is taking so long today. Haven't really investigated that yet. Well, this is too much. Can we? Well, what a great picture viewer. yeah. Anyway, so we have in this rack all of the non-pixelized machines are my machines, or awesome, or now PDM over IP machines. So we have the Cisco machine on top here, the AS5. 400 is not in use yet, but this is a large-scale RAS server. We have at the very bottom, we have the Livingston Portmaster. Let me see who develops an image viewer where you can zoom, but then if you zoom, it's always only full zoom. And then you cannot scroll in the fully zoomed image. Ah, but you can move it around, at least that, yeah. So at the very bottom, we have the Livingston Portmaster on a rack shelf, because somehow I didn't have the rack mount, the original rack mount ears. And then this machine here on top, this 3U Supermicro, that's our server called AVST, AVST, the Auslandsvermittlungsstelle. And on top in this 1U enclosure here, we have on the right-hand side, we have an embedded x86 board, a PC Engine's APU board that is connected to the ICE1 USB, which is inside this unit. And on the left-hand side, we have this board that I just showed, which has the overvoltage protection for the RS422 signals. And this green cable here is the signal that the 100 plus meters of Cat5 cable towards the GPS receiver on the roof. Lots of other machines which do not relate to the TDM over IP. So it's really just those three boxes that I mentioned. So yeah, this is a picture of the antenna on a container or some kind of construction on the roof. So we don't see half of the horizon, but it doesn't matter. Lots of satellites. This is the DIN rail that is inside this container. Well, it's actually larger than a container, but this whatever cabinet, like walk-in cabinet on the roof. Here we have our Ericsson GPS receiver. On the bottom, the GPS signal is not connected yet when the picture was taken. Here we have those three overvoltage protection devices. So we basically go out from the Ericsson device with this small pigtail here and go into this overvoltage protection array. This is the DIN rail power supply providing the 12 volts into this cable, into the GPS receiver. That's the physical setup. After the physical setup was completed in mid-September, there was all the software configuration setup stuff. And in October 1st, we rerouted the CNET enum from the IP address in my basement to the IP address or the host name now actually in the data center, meaning that our inbound CNET calls arrive on the new system. Users have all been migrated meanwhile. Don't know the exact date, but it's all done. And there's this wiki page, which I just showed you about the co-located hub. So what kind of software do we have? How does the logical setup work? We have this AVST server, the physical machine, which runs one VM and a number of LXC containers. It's not an LSC, it's an LXC, sorry for that. So we have the DIVF, the Digitale Vermittlung Fern. That's again a German postal acronym for a tandem exchange or something like that in English terms. It's a virtual machine with the two Digium 8-port E1 cards passed into the VM. We have Osmo E1D with DADI TrunkDev for the remote connections, so the TDM over IP connections that are arriving here. We have Yate as the simulated central switch, and we also now have Osmo ISDN tab, which I will mention briefly in a few minutes. To have call recording for further debugging and analysis. We also have a Grafana LXC with Stats Retro Networking Org. There we have the stats. So let's look at my statistics, for example, to see. So the video streaming of this talk did not impact my link quality. So what we can see here, in case you haven't seen these graph yet, we have basically a nice Grafana dashboard that ManaWorm put together. We see here packet errors. So every so often there is one, but rather rarely. We have underruns per second. We see how many time slots are being used, typically zero right now, since I'm not on the phone. But if I was to establish a call, we would see that change. And we can actually do this, of course, if I do put this to last 5 minutes and set like a 5 second refresh interval and dial a call. So now I'm just dialing a modem number from my desktop phone. So we should hear some nice modem tones shortly. Yeah, and here we also see the number of time slots in use increased to 2. So we don't only have the, yeah, that's already the least noisy sound level. So we have the D channel here, and now we also have the 1B channel that's currently in use in these other plots. Let me stop that sound. Yeah, we see packets per second, of course, increasing in both directions. Actually, that's strange. There's something wrong. The packets per second shouldn't increase. That's the bytes per second. I think there is something wrong with the labeling here. Yeah, the other plot that we see here is the FIFO level, which if we look at that, if the FIFO level is constant more or less over time, it means that the clocks at both sides are in sync, and the network latency doesn't change, which is the normal situation in a healthy setup. If we look, for example, at the event PBX1, and we go back a bit further in time, like we look at the last 2 days, yeah, then you see graphs like this. And this was basically the free running clock without any GPS sync and without a calibrated clock. So in this case, we see that the IP2E1 FIFO level at the hub is decreasing all the time over time. So meaning that the remote end is sending E1 frames slower than it should be. And at some point, we have an underrun. We get these nice spikes here about underrun frames. And then the FIFO fills again, and we have massive slips of packets, and then it starts again. And once we have a proper clock on the remote end, then it looks like this. And this was actually overnight a test that I did last night, which Sylvain suggested to basically sync it to GPS once, note the calibration values, basically the DAC values, that I used to tune the VCXO, disconnect the GPS and just let it run with those calibrated values. And you can see over the entire night, the FIFO level was stable. So we have very nice stability if we once had a proper calibration. I mean, this was overnight. So of course, my home office even has something like 4 or 5 centigrades less overnight. So there was quite a bit of temperature change also, and we don't even notice it here. So anyway, we have this nice Grafana VM, LXC container to look at statistics. I think we will add more statistics over time, of course. It would also be nice to get some Yate statistics in here. Yate has an SNMP interface. I haven't played yet with that, but I think we should have some code that pulls stuff out of this SNMP interface and pushes it into Grafana. For example, one thing that would be interesting is whether or not the layer 2 is up at all. I mean, this is all basically TDM over IP information right now, but it would also be interesting to see whether Q921 LabD protocol to each of the peers is up or not, and things like that. So we have a couple of other LXC containers. None of them are really used much yet. One I created for services, meaning I think that's, yeah, we actually run an instance of the Neu-Ulm, which is a BTX German. Teletext server. I think more services like stuff that you can reach through the Octo you could run on this container. We now have an OpenVPN server mainly for the event PBXs that I will mention before, so we can remotely access those if they are somewhere in the field. And there's also a Synchronet LXC with an installation of Synchronet, which is a maintained Linux open source BBS software. And I hope to find some time to actually fill that with life so we can run our own BBS locally as well, not just connect to remote BBSs over Telnet. Some update on Osmo E1D. It's actually not all that much that has happened, at least since April. In April, we had a number of changes still related to clocking and configuration of that and monitoring of that. But then was a long period of silence, and now we have a couple of changes recently. One of them is that we have a user manual as a PDF. It's linked from here, like most of the other Osmocom projects. We have support for the E1 Tracer hardware, which is not really relevant in this context. So I'll spare you the details here. If somebody wants to hear more about that, can talk about that later. And also we have RPM spec packaging now, so not just DPKG, but also RPM packages in the in our nightly and latest feeds. So one of the new projects that we have around in terms of software projects is Osmo ISDN Tab. We already had a number of different projects for tracing or recording E1 lines in various different ways. But they were all developed for, basically taking full E1 traces to analyze stuff that runs really over 2 megabits and is not very useful for narrowband ISDN tracing. So what we actually want is something that takes continuous D-channel traffic trace, so we see whatever is happening on the signaling side, and then also offers us some kind of raw captures of B-channel data, because the B-channel data is something that we want to study further and play with, because in the end, I think we want to have implementations for most of those bearer channel protocols in open source and accessible through the Octoe Hub. There's no need to use a Livingston Portmaster or a Cisco AS5400. And work around tons of bugs and shortcomings of this equipment if we can just terminate all of the X75 and V120 and whatever in open source on at our end, just in software. There's no need in wasting energy and so on in running that equipment. And of course, it helps our understanding of those protocols. So and in order to do that, of course, it's useful to have traces around. Also, we still have a problem with bit errors, and for that, it's also useful to have traces around so we can analyze and see whether we find some kind of patterns of these errors. That's basically what we want, and that's what Osmo ISDN Tab implements. It's a very simple hack at this point. It uses a feature called RX mirror and TX mirror. Those are I/O controls on Dardi. Just give me a second. Have a bit of a sore throat again for some reason. So these RX mirror and TX mirror I/O controls, you can issue them on Dardi D channels. So in Dardi, every not just D channels, but in Dardi channels to be more specific. So every Dardi channel, meaning an E1 or T1 time slot, you can create so-called RX mirror and TX mirror channels, and those channels receive basically a carbon copy of all of the data that is received or transmitted on that specific channel. And we use this feature on a system that is using Dardi anyway, which is, for example, the central hub. We create RX mirror and TX mirrors of the D channels, which provides us the D-channel protocol trace, which we export as GSM tab. They can be recorded with TCP dump, or you can look at them live in Wireshark. And in addition, on those D-channel messages, we filter all the I-frames from the LabD protocol. And those are the ones that carry layer 3 protocol, Q931, of course, not 391. Yeah. What you get from not proofreading your slides. In those Q931 messages, we then detect whenever there is an exclusive B-channel assignment. So in Q931, the B-channel allocation works in a way that in many cases, one side of the two can basically propose a certain B-channel to be used for a call during setup. And then the other side can either accept that or can instruct the call to use a different time slot. And this second part is the so-called exclusive B-channel, because it's basically then the definitive B-channel that is used for a call. So for each call that we see, when there is an exclusive B-channel assigned, we start a recording. Actually, the recording means we create two files, one for the RX and one for the TX direction of this time slot of this B-channel. And then we also have code that should detect whenever a call is disconnected, which we use to stop the recording. This works most of the time. Yesterday, I figured out there was a trace running for more than 24 hours for a call that clearly didn't exist anymore. So apparently, we still have some issues there. But as I said, it's a very simple hack. I can quickly show you how this looks like. Well, let's go for enormous. Now the question is, yes, 4270 is the port number. So it has a VTY interface, like all of the Osmocom stuff. And now, so here we are in the VTY interface. Actually, not sure if I can show much here. But what I can do is, of course, I can do logging enable. Config file looks like this. Basically, say, well, we configure the ISDN tab. We say, well, this is the directory to which to store the recordings. This is the IP address to use for sending the GSM tab frames for the D-channel signaling. And then we configure all the various lines which we want to trace. We give it an internal name, and we specify which is the DADI trunk device that we want to open as this line. And we specify whether our local role is network or user, because that gets encoded into the PCAP file, or rather in the, yeah, first in the GSM tab frames and later in the PCAP file, because it's relevant. So yeah, this is the restart messages that are being done by the Auerswald PBXs. The error message is bogus. So basically, it clears the state for all of the time slots, and there's a call reference zero being used. That's not really a call reference. So we get these bogus messages. But now if I again start my ISDN call, it basically detects here that there's a new call being established, and actually, we see cannot open B channel. That's even more interesting. Actually, that's also another bug. I'll explain just in a second, but we see I'm hanging up now. So let's terminate here and explain what happens. So it starts the B-channel recording on LaForge colon 1, means time slot 1 in the trunk that we called LaForge. And it then opens the files for RX and TX. The file names are constructed with ISDN tab, the trunk name, the calling party identifier. The called party identifier is empty in this case because, well, we haven't dialed yet at the time the setup message happens. This is late dialing or overlap dialing. And then the timestamp, so date and the time slot number and TX and RX. This cannot open B channel is just because we see another signaling message for the same channel, which would also trigger starting. But since it's already running the recording, we get this error message that should also be suppressed. It's not a real error here. And then we see, because we trace both sides, so basically this is the A leg of our call here, and then we see the B leg of the call on the portmaster side. PM3 is the Livingston portmaster. We see the same sequence of events here. Now, of course, we see the called party number, so calling party and called party, so the file names make more sense in this way. This is on time slot 4 here, so we have those recorded files. And now, for example, if we suspect that Yeat is creating some kind of distortion in the B channel, we can compare the data of those two and see if that is the case or is not the case. yeah, or analyze or whatever is happening there. So that's the, now let me switch off the screen share before I share again something that is not supposed to be shared. Oh, there we go. Back to the slides. Yeah, so that was the Osmo ISDN tab. Another thing that I recently worked on is these event PBXs. The primary trigger for this was that Kommunikationsnetz Franken, an old NGO about playing with internet technology, let me frame it like this, from the early 90s, has its annual annual conference, and I'm going to also remotely present on this TDM over IP network, and basically there they will put up a small PBX with some devices. This device will get picked up tomorrow, and our existing event deployment setup is rather large. I think it's a 6U rack, so quite heavy, not something you want to carry with you on a train or something like that. And I had the idea of basically putting all of these things into one enclosure. So it looks like this. Again, we can wait for this strange Redmine image viewer that has weird zoom levels and doesn't want to load the image for a long time. Okay, next time I'm going to use the local JPEG files. Not sure what is happening here. There we go. Well, looks on the outset, it looks like a normal 19-inch 3U Auerswald Commander Basic PBX, but internally some bits have been added. So you can see there is a beagle bone mounted to the right external wall from the inside. We have at the bottom here, we see that better in a different picture, a five-port Ethernet switch. We have the ICE-1 USB with, embarrassingly, the cable plugged into the wrong RJ45 socket. I only detected that after posting the picture. Here on the backhand side, we have an additional power supply that is not there in the original unit, which provides 12 volts for the switch and 5 volts for the BeagleBone. The fan was replaced for a silent fan, and that's basically it. So here on the faceplate, we have, this is the administrative Ethernet port. This is now actually leading to the switch, not to the PBX port anymore. So this is the internet uplink for the switch. We have here on the USB port, we have a USB serial converter with the console of the BeagleBone. And here we can connect on the SMA, we can connect to the GPS receiver for clock purposes. So here you can again, I'll leave it like this. We can see from the top view, and there's some more pictures. This unit, meanwhile, has been assembled in a 3U flight case, such as used by musicians on stage. So this is now fully ruggedized and portable, and all you need to do is connect power and Ethernet and optionally GPS, and that's it. So that's... also why I set up the VPN server. The Octoy traffic doesn't go through that VPN, but just in case one wants to remotely check the system through this VPN, we can reach those as soon as they come up with. One is fully assembled. The other three are almost fully assembled. The only bit missing is ICE-1 USB, where we are waiting for the latest, for the reworks to be completed. Ro is here in the channel. Unfortunately, DigiKey did some programming error with the VCXOs, so we had 105 newly produced circuit boards with the wrong clock. Ro had to rework those units, and as soon as I have a couple of them, I can complete those other units. But we don't need four right now, so it's not urgent. One of them is important, that one is complete, and the other ones are just for future use cases. Yeah, then we have some bit error problems that haven't been fully understood yet. Most of this has been researched by Manaworm so far, so maybe it's actually something he should say something about it. Yeah, we have a couple of bit error testers. Manaworm has these Argos devices. I have the Protel 93E, which is the German postal system ISDN test phone, and with those devices we can very clearly established there are bit errors. I don't think they are coming from the... I would personally think it's Dadi or Yeet. I don't think it's Octoy to be blamed, since we had so much E1-wide bit error testing already, and we never could establish any errors just over the TDM over IP. So that needs to be further debugged. Haven't really been able to dive into this further, other than also, yes, I can demonstrate there are bit errors, but I don't know where they occur yet. But now with the Osmo ISDN tab, that was also one of the reasons why I spent time on this, we can actually have raw recordings. Now what's next would be software to correlate those raw recordings on, let's say, the left-hand side of Yeet and the right-hand side of Yeet, and see if those agree, or maybe also on my side, my end of the Octoy link and the hub side, and see where exactly and how those errors manifest themselves, and then hopefully resolve them soon. Yeah, and last but not least, need to get back to the slides. We have some Yeet problems. I'm not sure if anyone knows somebody with a decent amount of Yeet background. I would be very interested in talking to such a person, because there are some things that just, I don't really see how this could have ever worked. And that needs to be investigated. One of those problems is that, I mean, in Yeet you have some simple modules. I'm not sure of what the official name is, but basically you can route a call to a module that just records audio, for example, or that plays back audio, so like an announcement text, or text melody, whatever, announcement audio. But the way this is done, you never see a call.answer message, and that is what triggers the actual connect on ISDN level. So if you call such a module and you route to an odd wave playback module, you get the wave played back as long as basically in the phase while the remote end has not connected yet. It's still the alerting phase, and then at some point there's a timeout, and then it just ends. And as I said, I don't really see how this could have ever worked. It's clear that this event is, or this call.answer message is missing, but I don't see any code in Yeet when I grab through the sources in such constellations that would generate the event. So yeah, that's another, it's not super critical. I mean, for normal calls, routing between two subscribers, it works. But for doing some more advanced stuff, it really, is interesting, let's say. Yeah, one thing on my agenda now for the winter is to resume work on the basic rate interface, so we finally can connect smaller setups than a 3U rack mount PBX with a primary rate interface. Just a quick recall, we started last year, I think, designing and building some basic rate interface devices. I built three prototypes and shipped two of them to several people here in the group. So what we have here is an XHFC2U chip. That's a dual basic rate interface channel ISDN controller. It has an SPI interface towards the basically here exposed on a header. So this really is only the ISDN interface. We have the 8P8C or 8P4C connectors. Actually, we have jumpers for selecting TENT mode. We have the magnetics, the analog adaptation circuit, and this controller. And this was connected to a to various other boards. And Manaworm has mentioned that he got it to a point where basically it was working. Now after these first prototype and evaluation boards, the idea is to make a board that has a microcontroller on board, on the same board. So we have a single board that has a microcontroller with Ethernet interface, and this ISDN controller, and also a GPS a receiver for a GPS and a VCXO, like the ICE1 USB, and those two basic RAID interfaces. That's on the hardware side the next step, but the most important step now is the software side, basically connecting this SPI interface to the microcontroller evaluation board and getting some basic, at least proof of concept firmware done, which then implements our TDM over IP protocol, and we can have the evaluation board with this board together, connecting an ISDN phone or a terminal adapter to our network. And once this is implemented, then yeah, the hardware, putting both of those things on one board, is basically then the least amount of effort. But it's the software side that I need to work on, continue to work on. That's the status. Here was a something that Manaworm showed. Basically connecting this to a SPI interface and talking to it from a normal Linux SPI. TNT mentions whether a BeagleBone module would be an option for a custom PCB. Yes, that might be an option. My idea was to use some Cortex M4, I think it was, microcontrollers, and I already bought them to make sure we have them sufficiently in stock, since it's always difficult with microcontrollers. But indeed, the Beagle might be an easier way to do this without having to do too much bare iron stuff on a microcontroller. It's an idea. Raspberry Pi Shield, definitely not. I don't think the situation with availability will change. At least not in the... I think even everybody looking at the market says, another year or so. No, not a good idea. To build some hardware, which then nobody can get embedded board for it. That I think covers it, what I wanted to discuss. We have lots of things to do on our to-do list. Lots of things are working, but definitely lots of more things should be working. I think one of the most important bits is to resolve those bit error problems that we have, since that, of course, impacts everything. For voice, it's barely noticeable, if at all, but for video calls, you already see it affects the performance of ISDN video calls, and for modem calls, of course, even more so. Okay. Any questions or discussions or whatever that you want to have on the record?
Well, one thing. With regards to the bit error rate, one thing I noticed that the bit errors were not happening in my test setup between two of my Linux boxes with very similar setups to the Octoy setup. So I will be investigating the Nuremberg box further. Maybe we have a configuration issue somewhere, and the ISDN recorder will really be coming in very useful for taking a closer look at that. One other thing, the trunk def that we now have in Osmo A1D and all of the other utilities really seems to be working very well. And do we want to someday merge that into the master or main branches?
Yeah, I think so. I would have to revisit and see if something needs to be cleaned up. But indeed, it has proven itself over months now, rather stable. So it should be merged for sure in the E1D. with regards to Dadi, it's a bit unclear what is master there anyway, with all the different repositories and so on. But let's see. But yeah. The other thing I want to do, I forgot to mention, is the Osmo ISDN tab. I also actually already started, but the code is not complete yet. It's far from being complete. Is have E1D support, not just Dadi. So that you can basically use Osmo E1D as a provider or driver to feed into Osmo ISDN tab to make recordings. Because right now, let's say you have a normal, let's say, user side setup of Octoi, then you have an ICE1 USB and you have Osmo E1D. And unless you put additional stuff behind it, like a soft PBX with Dadi cards and so on, you wouldn't be able to run the Osmo ISDN tab there. And if Osmo E1D had something like the RX mirror or TX mirror IO controls of Dadi, then Osmo ISDN tab could basically attach to that and also create recordings on that side. So that I think would be very useful to complete that side. And it's not a lot of work, but as I said, haven't been able to complete it yet.
Another thing, have you taken a look at the complexity of adding basic rate support to trunk dev and all the E8 stuff in general for that?
Not really. I mean, E8 itself, I think it claims to do basic rate.
Seems as far to as work,
Yeah, so I have never used a basic grade Digium card, for example, with E8. For the protocol, I mean, my naive approach would really just be to start with what we have and just expand the 16 kilobit D channel to 64 kilobit. Padded, use just 2 bits of every byte for now. And then it should work basically. So I think that's also how I believe Dadi represents basic rate interfaces, is to have 3 channels, the 2B channels and 1D channel. And the D channel, I think, also gives you 8,000 bytes per second, right? Or how do you know the details?
8,000 bytes? No, I don't know.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, I think it also no, it doesn't. It's HDLC probably you operated in that mode. Anyway, I have to investigate. But as far as I saw, it's very close to that. And if on the protocol level we also treat it like that, so we just have, instead of frames with 32 bytes, we have frames with up to 3 bytes. We can increase the batching if needed, but apart from that.
Okay, thanks.
I mean, it's not efficient, but it would work. And I mean, you can always improve from there if needed, if efficiency is needed at all at those pitch rates. Maybe another thing that has happened, I just had a brief conversation with TNT again about this. So he created a hack, unfortunately, nothing that he wanted to release at the time, where he implemented the idea of using an ICE1 USB without GPS by using the 5-fold level as a target. as far as I recall. So the idea was to basically, in absence of any clock reference, just look at the FIFO level and try to keep the FIFO level constant, and assume if the FIFO level is constant, then the clocks will be in sync. And I think that performed relatively well in his experiment. So definitely, I think it makes also an interesting project to properly do that or get that in a state that it can be merged. I think particularly for more wider use and for the basic rate interface, not everybody will have GPS available at the location, and that might be an approach there. One thing I forgot about the basic rate interface, one of the ideas there was also to add the original idea was to have this single board with the microcontroller going from Ethernet to S0 or basic rate, and have maybe an add-on board which would add a PoE capability for supplying this board, but then on the other hand side also provide the 40 odd volts of phantom voltage to the basic rate interfaces, so you can power your telephones and so on, and having all of that with PoE. So fitting all of this on a BeagleBone head would probably be hard. So definitely we'd also be talking about two modules at this, two layers of PCBs stacked to it. Not sure if I know there are PoE heads for the Raspi. I'm not sure there are existing ones for the BeagleBone. I personally would really like the idea of just plugging something into PoE Ethernet and having ISDN basic ports on the other end. Ah, yeah, okay. TNT mentions he would, this OV, whatever, I think it's, yeah, I know what you mean, the device that the BeagleBone module, the solder module that you put on the board, that might also make sense. Not sure what the availability
is. Those like $50 each.
Yeah, okay. That's also not nice. Okay, unobtainium, yeah. Well, we'll see. maybe I'll try to give it a quick shot with the Cortex M microcontroller and Nutix. I did some work before with Nutix and Ethernet on Cortex M, and had rather nice experience actually. So let's see, maybe that is feasible. Nice part about Nutix is that you really have a POSIX API, so you can have a relatively portable application code using socket APIs and stuff like that. Between a normal user space program on Linux and running inside Nutix RTOS on some microcontroller.